Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and you're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world. And we need to have all kinds of information because there are toxic chemicals all around us in the consumer products that we use every day. Just walking out our front doors, there's toxic chemicals falling from the sky and pesticides on lawns and car exhaust, and all around us there are toxic chemicals. But we can be free of the negative health effects of all these toxic chemicals by learning how to minimize our exposure to them and remove them from our bodies. Today, it's Thursday, August 22nd, 2013. I'm here in Clearwater, Florida, and it's kind of cloudy. Maybe there might be a thunderstorm, so if you lose me, that's why, but I'll be right back. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, PhD, DABT. He's a toxicologist, the director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology, and author of the book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals. He received his PhD in toxicology in 1986 from the University of Rochester, New York, and he's a diplomat of the American Board of Toxicology and an affiliate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences in the University of Washington. So he has a lot of experience with toxic chemicals, and 1986, that was about when I started getting interested in toxic chemicals. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Gilbert.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. So tell us, how did you get interested in toxic chemicals of all things?
Well, you know, I sort of came at that a little bit sideways. My background is actually in electrical engineering, and I did a lot of computer work after I graduated, and a lot of that was related to testing and designing programs for testing on toxic chemicals. So I sort of came into it that way, and I got very interested in the effects of chemicals, particularly on the developing nervous system, and how to prevent chemicals such as lead and mercury from affecting the developing nervous system. So I went back to school about 6 years after I graduated to get my PhD and really devote myself to trying to lessen the effects of chemicals on the developing nervous system.
That's a very good thing to do. We share that interest in preventing the
We really have to focus on prevention. Treatment is great, but we really need to focus on prevention.
I totally agree. So what does a toxicologist do?
That's a really good question. Toxicologists do a range of things, and that's one reason I liked about the field about toxicology is that you can do it for testing chemicals. You can do regulatory work on policy development, determining what chemical levels might be safe in the environment or in the food supply or the water supply. So there's a range of jobs in the state and federal area. There's also pharmaceutical companies employ a lot of toxicologists for developing new drugs and testing the health and safety of the new drugs. Pesticide manufacturers, so the agriculture industry, employs toxicologists. So there's really a wide range. I don't do any research anymore. Oh, in the academic environment, of course, a lot of toxicologists work in the academic environment looking at the health effects of chemicals. I don't do any research anymore. My focus is really on how we talk about toxicology, how we inform people. So my view is we know how to learn more and more about less and less. We're really good at doing research. What we don't do such a good job of is connecting the dots and really getting information out there to people so we can make better decisions about our health.
I actually agree with that, and that's part of why I inform the public about toxicology information is because I don't think that the field is informing the public enough. I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, I really agree. I really appreciate what you're trying to do here because I think it is really important to talk about these issues and get more information out there about it. Because we know lots of stuff. We just don't use it well.
Yeah, I agree, and that's one of the reasons why I asked you to be on the show, and I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope you'll come again, and maybe again and again and again, because
sure.
I only know as much as I can learn as a consumer and somebody that didn't even take chemistry in school. But I just sat down when I got to a point in my life where I needed to understand toxic chemicals because they were making me sick. I just sat down with a chemistry dictionary, and I looked up formaldehyde, And then it said, this is what how formaldehyde is made or something. And then I went and looked up the other chemicals that went into it. And that's how I learned about chemistry, was just reading a chemistry dictionary. But you're so trained in this field that all of us who are listening and everybody in the world need to be hearing from people like you to educate us, because we all, in the world that we're living in today, we all need to be toxicologists. We all need to be understanding the chemicals around us and knowing how to protect ourselves from them.
So I think that's really true, because we do need to know the basics, and that's why I wrote my book, Small Dose of Toxicology, as an introductory book to the toxicology and health effects of common chemicals that we're all exposed to. So I think it's very important to learn at least the principles of that, because a lot of decisions are made around toxic chemicals.
They are, and I haven't read all of your book, but I've been reading it in small doses.
Very good.
And I really love the approach that you have. I love that you're tying everything that you're saying to daily life, and I love that you're saying things in a simple way, and then also providing more resources. And I really think I see a lot of similarities between what I'm doing and what you're doing, especially looking at a small dose of toxicology. Some of the principles that you covered were the same things that I felt I needed to cover in my book so that people could have a basic understanding. But of course, you're writing about it from your knowledge as a trained toxicologist, where I'm just writing about it as somebody who reads about it but hasn't been trained.
That's a very important perspective, though, because we all are affected by toxic chemicals. I think that perspective is really important. I think just a quick mention is that Small Dose is free. It's a free ebook, so it can be downloaded off the web for free.
Yes, and I would suggest that everybody go and download it, because it really is, even if you only read part of it, the parts of it that explain the basics of toxicology are really, really excellent. And these are things that every single person needs to know on the planet. You need to know this, like you need to know the alphabet or how to add and subtract. It's just basics of life in the way the world is today. And in fact, let's just talk more about, right now, let's talk more about what's on your website. It's toxipedia.org, and that's where you can go to find the book, toxipedia.org. And why don't you tell us about different kinds of resources you have there? I know the thing that's important to say about this, why this is different from, other websites about toxic chemicals, is that you really explore the world of toxicology in the context of history, society, and culture. And so one of the things that you can find out on this website, for example, is the whole history of toxicology going back to ancient times. It's not toxic chemicals didn't just appear in the 1940s when they started making pesticides. Toxic chemicals exist, and Dr. Gilbert really put the whole field together in a way that is very fascinating. So tell us more about what they can find on your website.
Oh, thank you, Deborah. Yeah, I think the history, putting the science in a context of history, society, and culture is very important. We just can't throw a lot of facts out there. I mean, there's a lot of heartfelt issues around toxicology that I think need to be explored. And we have a lot of lessons learned if we look historically. So I try to put the chemicals and the other information in that context, in the context of history and society, so we know where we're coming from and I know how to avoid some of these mistakes. One thing we did was make an interactive poster called Milestones of Toxicology. So the milestone poster is a colorful poster that has little squares on it, and you can explore those squares. You open it up. As a PDF file, you can click on one of those squares and get more information. And that poster has now been translated into over 10 languages. So it's in Spanish and Portuguese and Chinese and French and Italian, Turkish, Arabic. So it's very fun poster, fun information. So one thing we tried to do was make toxicological information fun. We also have a big education section, and that explores small dose. And there's material to run 1- and 2-day toxicology courses. Each chapter of the Small Dose book comes with a PowerPoint presentation that you can download to help teaching the material. We have sections on ethics. I think ethics and the values, how to make decisions, is really important. We also support a number of other websites, which have a a pretty wide range, one of the most
recent ones. I need to interrupt you for a minute because we do need to go to our station break, and then we'll be right back and we can continue. I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist, author of Small Dose of Toxicology. I'm Deborah Lindad, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, who is a toxicologist and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and he's got a great website, toxipedia.org, toxipedia.org. And before I interrupted him, Dr. Gilbert was telling us about what's on his website, so why don't you go on and finish what you want to say about that?
So I was just talking about the different sections we have. We have a lot of material there. It's a free wiki-based site, so we're always looking for contributions. For example, on the front page, I was just mentioning the ethics part. We talk about environmental justice issues and decision-making process. We have a section on the precautionary principle. Hopefully we'll get into that a little bit more later. Uh-huh. We also have a section called the Toxicology History Room, which has a number of posters that are contributed from people around the world. And you can actually request the Toxicology History Room posters to be at your facility. We have a section called Lessons Learned, where we have different essays, explore past issues around toxicology. We have a day-to-day issues around toxicology that every day, and I tweet about this every day, I put up an issue that, or a historical fact that occurred on toxicology. So we try to make toxicology interesting. We support a number of other sites, like the World Library of Toxicology. Smalldoseof.org supports the Small Dose of Toxicology book. We have a new website coming up that's just getting going called Women in Peace. And we have a site called Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center that we support that focuses on Hanford and toxicology issues around Hanford, the most contaminated site in the Northern Hemisphere that was used to create plutonium for World War II. And we also have a site called Integrated Pest Management on IPMOpedia that looks at integrated pest management issues. So we cover a wide range of areas, and you can search Toxipedia, and I hope you enjoy exploring it.
I've been enjoying exploring it very much, and I'm sure I haven't seen all of it yet. There's a lot there, it's all presented in an interesting and simple way. So very well done.
Thank you.
I also wanted to say that it was interesting to me when I started reading A Small Dose of Toxicology. Oh, one thing I want to make sure that everybody sees is, and I always have trouble finding it, is that you have a page where you list, where you talk about different toxic chemicals and give background on that, such as you do in A Small Dose of Toxicology has a small list, but you have more on your website. And I always have difficulty finding it. But it's there, so people should search for it. What I wanted to say about the chemicals that are in A Small Dose of Toxicology is that I had to smile when I read this, because the number one toxic chemical that you list, not that you are rating them as being the most important, but the first one that you chose to address was alcohol, alcoholic beverages. And in my book, Toxic Free, that was number two. And then the second toxic chemical, and the reason why I want to mention this is because people usually think of toxic chemicals as being something like formaldehyde or benzene or something like that. But in your book, Small Dose of Toxicology, the first one you address is alcoholic beverages. And the second one you address is caffeine, like
right.
in coffee and chocolate and all those other caffeine-laden foods. And number three is nicotine. And in my book, Toxic Free, the number one that I discussed first was cigarettes. Nicotine and cigarettes. So we have a very similar approach as to what we started our books with.
Very good.
A lot of similarity. And then we go off in different directions. But the fact that we both started with the basics of toxicology and the same toxic chemicals, I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's very good. I think that's very important because those are chemicals we're all commonly exposed to, that we need to understand the potential health effects of those chemicals.
We do, and I think that if somebody is drinking a lot of alcoholic beverages, if they're drinking a lot of coffee, there's the caffeine and there's the pesticides and all the pollution in the water and everything, or if they're smoking a lot of cigarettes, if they're doing any of those three things, I think that those are going to make them sick, and you could eliminate some other toxic chemical down the line, like formaldehyde on bed sheets or something. But it's not going to help to do that if you're doing these big things, those right. big three things. Good. I'm glad we agree.
Yeah, we totally agree on that.
Okay, so could you tell us about individual sensitivities and how people react or are poisoned in different ways?
Well, that's, I think, a really important issue with individual sensitivity. And I think as we understand the genome better and science has progressed, that's become more and more important, is understanding who is most sensitive to chemicals. For example, pesticides are a good example of that, where some people are more sensitive to pesticides because they don't metabolism as well. So if you get what's called the healthy worker effect. So workers that work in pesticide fields tend to metabolize pesticides faster and deal with them. People that are slow metabolizers don't work well in pesticide fields and tend to drop out of the industry. So you get people that are more resilient to pesticides. So there's many chemicals that are like that. Lead, for example. The more we've learned about lead, the more we've found that people are sensitive to lead at a very young age, and developing nervous systems exquisitely sensitive. So taking into account age and health effects of chemicals is really, really important. The developing nervous system is exquisitely sensitive to pesticides, lead, mercury. And we've learned that over the last 20 years, how sensitive that is. And metabolism is very important, how well you metabolize a compound. And your genetics is very important in that area also. So there's a lot of issues. Always remember that kids are not little adults because they eat more, breathe more, and drink more than adults do per body weight. So there's sensitivity like that. Kids have hand-to-mouth behavior. So there's a lot of interesting issues you need to take into account when looking at toxic effects of a chemical.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that was of interest to me as I was studying and learning these things too, because you think that, like you read in a book, this chemical is toxic, or that chemical is toxic, but then how is it toxic to you? And that's a whole different question. After we take our commercial break here, I want to ask you this question about how is it determined that a chemical is toxic? Because there's so much variation in how our bodies receive the toxicity and what our bodies do with these toxic chemicals. How can we figure out what's really toxic? And there's so many variations about that. So we're going to address that after this commercial break. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. Yes, it is. I'm talking to Stephen Gilbert. He's a toxicologist, Dr. Stephen Gilbert, author of A Small Dose of Toxicology. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, PhD, DABT, and he's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology and the publisher of a huge and wonderful website on toxicology called toxipedia.org, TOXIPEDIA.org. Before the break, I asked a question, and I want to repeat the question because I really have two questions, and they're related to each other. So I think what I asked you before the break was about to tell us about the individual differences that we have in our bodies that would make a chemical more or less toxic to us. But there's another question, too, and you probably need to answer these one at a time, but I want to ask them both at once. There's a lot of controversy about whether or not a chemical is toxic. And so I'm looking at a lot of industrial things that are happening with, like, manufacturers and regulations, which I think we're going to talk about later if we have some time. But people are saying toxic chemicals need to be regulated, or we should be labeling things in certain ways. But then there's a question about what are the toxic chemicals that need to be regulated, and is the chemical toxic? Those are the two things I'd like us to talk about next. Big questions, huh?
Yeah, those are huge questions. I'll just, one quick example on different sensitivities is with caffeine. You know, caffeine is a stimulant, And some people can drink caffeine at dinner time and not have any problems with going to sleep. Other people, like myself, rarely drink caffeine after noon or 2 o'clock at the latest because it does affect our sleep. So we respond and react to chemicals very differently, and that's just a simple example. Some people will get a headache when they stop drinking caffeine, and that's another example of individual sensitivity. So it varies widely about our genetic response of different chemicals. Now, to the other question of determining toxicity, that's we know how to do that in a lot of cases. For example, the Food and Drug Administration requires that new drugs go under extensive testing to show health effects and also efficacy. So does it do what it says it's supposed to do? So new drugs coming on the market have gone through extensive animals and human testing before they're allowed to be marketed. And this came from historical issues. For example, thalidomide that occurred when it caused birth defects when thalidomide was consumed during organogenesis by the pregnant woman. So we have a strong history, a very precautionary approach with putting new drugs on the market. Unfortunately, we don't have that with new chemicals going on in the market.
But wait, I want to ask you a question about drugs.
Sure.
So all these drugs are tested, but what are they tested for in order to be able to be allowed on the market? Because if anybody watches television at all, you can't watch television without seeing these advertisements for all these drugs, and then they say in a very nice voice, while children are playing in the meadow and the butterflies are flying and music in the background, and this drug will cause blindness and death and liver problems and be precautionary, you know, but all these drugs are on the market with all these side effects.
Right. Yeah, that's good to know about that, and that's what a lot of this the testing of these compounds try to determine are what are the potential side effects. And what they try to do with the drugs is have the exposure to the drug low enough so you don't encounter the side effects. And that's part of the trick is knowing at what level a drug becomes toxic and the benefits are outweighed by the hazards of that drug. And the new drugs are, they try to determine what might be the potential hazards of those chemicals through animal testing and also through a lot of experience with human testing. And they're required by law to read them off. If we had the same thing happen with industrial chemicals we're exposed to, we'd have a much better idea of chemicals in our products. Like right now.
That would be great. That would be so great.
There's no law that requires what fragrances are put in, dryer towels and things like that. We don't know a lot of the chemicals we're exposed to because we're not required to list them.
Right.
So that's a huge problem. We don't have the same precautionary approach to putting new chemicals on the market. Like everybody, most people on this call will be excreting bisphenol A in their urine. And I bet nobody gave permission to be exposed to bisphenol A.
Right. And so now let's use bisphenol A as the example for this question, because you can read things that say books like Our Stolen Future that talk about the health effects of bisphenol A, and then you can read all kinds of other things that say, oh, this government agency and this doctor say, oh, it doesn't hurt us, and so we have in the general public. Or I was reading something this morning that just came out last week. There was a new study that showed that not only is there lead in lipstick. This was an article in the New York Times. I don't know if you saw this.
I saw that.
Yeah. Okay. So in that article in the New York Times, which I'm going to be putting up on my website this afternoon, in that article, they talked about how there's all now these 8 heavy metals that they found in lipstick. But just in terms of lead in lipstick, the amount that they found was 1 part per million. But the FDA limit for lead in candy is 1/10 of that, 0.1 part per million. And the CDC says there's no safe level for lead. So how are we supposed to know as consumers what is okay for us to be exposed to?
You know, that is really tough. You just pointed out a great example of the contradiction in our regulatory field where lipstick should be regulated like candy at least, because you lick the lipstick off your lips. You're being exposed.
Lipstick.
Kids younger and younger are using lipstick, and they're exposed to lead, which is a known hazard, and there is no safe level of lead exposure. So to have this disparity in the standards is silly.
I think it's silly, too. And this is where it's just more and more as I study everything about life, I see that there are basic things that need to be understood. And yet we have people running the world who don't understand basic things. And toxicology is one of those basic things. It's just something, it should be taught in every school, that everybody, the things that we're talking about here, everybody needs to know. And if people who are making regulations don't know these things, we're not going to get them on the labels. That we're not, you know, there's so much I could say. Probably so much you could say.
I know. It is really difficult because, you know, our regulatory system is sometimes gets disconnected from the health issues and trying to prevent disease. Lipstick is a great example. Mercury in fish is another one. Bisphenol A is another one. Just a recent book just came out on bisphenol A called Is It Safe? And it gives a lot of the history of the BPA and the struggle to define the safety of chemicals by Sarah Vogel. And that gives a really great background on the controversy around BPA and the vested interests that often promote these products. Lead, for example, has been promoted for decades in lead-based paint. It was added to gasoline. It took a lot of work to get lead out of gasoline, and even more work to ban lead-based paint. And if you look at what they did in Europe, they banned lead-based paint in Europe in the 1920s, the League of Nations, because they recognized that it'd be hazard to the developing nervous system. We didn't do that in the United States because there was vested interest that wanted to put lead in paint because they're making a lot of money from mining and use of lead.
And I have to interrupt you again, or else the commercial's going to interrupt you.
Okay,
I'm here with Dr. Stephen Gilbert. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's a toxicologist and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and he has a very extensive, easy-to-read, informative website called Toxipedia.org. It's TOXIPEDIA.org. Dr. Gilbert, I know that you want to talk about managing chemical exposures at the state and national level. So since we're now in our last segment, let's talk about that.
Okay, thank you. So I just want to mention that, you know, the federal agencies, the FDA and EPA, work very hard trying to protect public health. And they attach safety factors to different drugs or chemicals that are out in the environment. And those safety factors are meant to protect people that are potentially vulnerable. The problem is that there are vested interests that push back on this really hard. BPA is a great example where the chemical industry is a $1 billion-a-year product. And it's in all kinds of products that we touched, our cash register receipts. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
It was in liner cans and things like that. So trying to get corral that chemical is very difficult, and they just limited it in baby bottles, so it's not used in baby bottles, but that mostly came about because states passed laws banning BPA from baby bottles and Nalgene drinking bottles for water.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a combination of trying to get the federal people to be more proactive on protecting human health. And when you look at internationally, this has been a big issue. We are trying to replace it. TSCA, the Toxic Substance Control Act,
right,
that was passed in 1976, and that's not gone well. It's still bottled up in Congress. They've been trying for almost a decade. It's the oldest law, environmental chemical law, that hasn't been modified since it passed in 76. And Europe has moved ahead with a program called REACH, Registration, Evaluation, Authorization of Chemicals, trying to provide more transparency and more data on these chemicals. Because TSCA doesn't require the companies to produce a lot of data on health effects of chemicals, unlike the FDA, which it does require drugs to have all this data to back up the potential side effects or point out the potential hazards of a drug. We do not have that for standard chemicals. In addition, we don't have a good law to give us transparency so we know what's in the products we're using, which I think we have a right to know. I think it's very important.
We do have a right to know. And this, I just want to back up what you're saying here and really emphasize it, because in order for us to make a decision about our exposure to toxic chemicals, we need to know what's in the product, what toxic chemicals are in the product, and we need to know what are the health effects of those toxic chemicals. And unless we have both of those pieces of information, we can't make a decision.
Right. I think that's really important point, that we have a right to that information. We have a right to an environment that we can reach, maintain our full potential, and particularly for children. We expose children to PCBs and lead and alcohol, mercury. They rob them of their potential, and it robs adults, too, of their potential as they get older and age. So we have a right to a healthy and safe environment, and that's not being honored by our regulatory structure right now.
Well, we have the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the first one is life. And toxic chemicals take life away. And to
they
some
do. They
people,
do. They have a lot of long-term effects. Lead, you damage a developing nervous system with lead. It's a lifetime effect. Lower their IQ, increase the probability of attention deficit disorders. It's really tragic. And we've made this mistake again and again. You look internationally in Nigeria, 400 kids died from lead exposure because of gold mining.
Yeah.
Same thing in the Amazon over mercury exposure. We know better. We know what not to be doing.
Well, we know better. And also, I think that within each one of us, we know, we have consciences. We know that we should be doing the right thing. And is the right thing to continue to allow this to happen? Or is the right thing to do what we need to do to clean it up? I mean, this whole thing about toxic chemicals in industry is less than 200 years old. And granted that there was toxic things, you'll find on Dr. Gilbert's website that toxic exposures go way back into ancient times. But this whole thing of being constantly bombarded by toxic chemicals, 24 hours a day in everything that we do is less than 200 years old and the result of our industrial culture.
I think a good to read on that I'd really recommend it. It's Doubt is Our Product by David Michaels. It goes into history of like the tobacco industry and how the tobacco industry for years said that their product was not toxic and that industry has manufactured uncertainty around toxicology data. So it's a very important book. Doubt is Our Product by David Michaels. It delves into history and how industry has responded to a regulatory process.
Thank you. So we only have a few minutes left. Let's talk about the precautionary principle. Tell us what that is. That's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, I love the precautionary principle. So the precautionary principle is really an approach to decision making. It really says, you know, you put the burden of responsibility on the proponents of an activity so that the proponents of an activity should show that a chemical is safe and efficacious and not cause hazards. And it also has a component by education, have people a transparent process in educating people about it. So example is the Food and Drug Administration does take a precautionary approach to putting drugs in the market. We don't have that same approach with putting industrial chemicals. So the burden of proof, the burden of responsibility is put on the proponents of an activity. I spent years doing research on lead and mercury funded by taxpayer dollars while industry spent all their time arguing that lead was safe and no problem. Instead of having the burden of responsibility, if they're putting it out in the environment, they should be funding the research to demonstrate safety. So the precautionary principle really shifts that around and says the proponents of activity have to invest, have to provide the data to show that this product is safe and efficacious. And I think that's the base of the precautionary principle. And it really says that uncertainty should not be a reason for not taking action. So even if there's some uncertainty about the potential health effects, we take action on the preponderance of data and not demand proof. And that's what hung up the tobacco industry in many decisions is industry demanded, well, how do you prove tobacco products cause cancer? And for years, we went around and around that circle by the preponderance of evidence was that tobacco products do indeed cause cancer and nicotine was addictive, which was finally proven. But we have to jump through a lot of hoops to do that and spend millions of dollars while industry makes a lot of profit from these products and not taking on the responsibility of health and safety to the general population.
So I've been working in this field for 30 years, not as a toxicologist, but as a consumer advocate. And so I've been in the position of making decisions and giving advice about helping consumers find products that are less toxic. And so in order to do that, I need to be able to make a decision about what I think is toxic and what I don't think is toxic. And the way I've done that is to read as much as I can about what scientists have to say about these chemicals, but also to see what my own body is doing when it comes in contact with these chemicals. And just, I do listen to anecdotal evidence. And I was writing about how toxic carpets were long before there were any measurements of toxic chemicals coming off of carpets, because I could see people getting sick from them. And so my viewpoint about this is that if I can observe a negative health effect, or if there's any question about it, I'll go on the side of precaution. And that I know, as the more experience I have, the more I've been, like, now I'm wanting to really be able to differentiate between what is a chemical that some people might have some individual response to versus something like DDT, for example, or lead, where really it's going to be dangerous to anybody. And that even if somebody isn't visibly showing a poisoning response, that eventually enough will build up into their body where it's going to cause a health effect. And if I suspect that that's what's going on by what I've read or what I've observed, then I'll say, we should just stay away from this, because I've found that there are less toxic ways to do almost anything.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. You take a precautionary approach based on your own observations, your own individual sensitivity, and looking for alternatives. And that's one of the points of precautionary principle. Pick a lesser hazard. Using flame retardants is a good example of that, where cotton and wool are naturally flame retardant, but you lose these synthetic fibers, they have flame retardants in them. We just don't need to go there. We don't need to be doing that.
So I think there's an alternative.
There are good alternatives. Yeah. And we also need to know more about our products. I really believe that's really the case. We should not have to worry about lead in jewelry or lead in candy, which are obviously, right, you know, it's to do. And we're still bombarded by products that have lead-based paint on them and lead in candy.
And it's not on the label. And, you know, I think if we could just get this stuff on the label, or even if it's not on the label, if you could go online and look up a product and see, even though it's not required by law, this is what's in it. That people's decisions, that the whole economy would shift, because people would be looking for products that didn't have toxic chemicals in them.
Knowing what products have phthalates in it, cosmetics that have phthalates in them that carry fragrances or in nail polish, we should know what's in these products and what we're being exposed to and how much we're being exposed to. People that work in nail salons get differentially exposed to these products, as well as in day-to-day users of these products. There's just no reason not to know what's in these products.
Yes, and we were coming up on the end of the show now. So thank you so much, Dr. Gilbert, for being on the show. And I would love to have you on again.
Enjoyed this.
And we'll talk soon.
You're
listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad.